طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. Today we will hear a forum that they tried to censor by denying it a venue, until Union Theological Seminary opened their doors and welcomed the event into their chapel. Journalist and author Ta-Nehisi Coates, Columbia professor Rashid Khalidi, and civil rights attorney Michelle Alexander speak out against the genocide that Israel and our government is perpetrating in Gaza with our money and in our name.
Next, we have a discussion featuring Professor Rashid Khalidi from Columbia University. He's the author of many books, most recently, 100 Years War on Palestine. He will be in conversation with Ta-Nehisi Coates, author of several books as well, including Between the World and Me, which won the National Book Award. Moderating their conversation will be Michelle Alexander, who welcomed us into this space earlier tonight. Michelle is a civil rights lawyer and the author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Time of Color Blindness. And she wrote about the connection between black liberation and Palestinian freedom years ago. Please join me in welcoming Michelle Alexander, Rashid Khalidi, and Ta-Nehisi Coates to the stage.
Well, thank you both for being here. We don't have much time together tonight, so I want to kind of dive right in. I really want to begin by asking you both about your personal connection to the people of Palestine. It's certainly not necessary to travel to Palestine or to have friends or family members in Palestine in order to speak and act courageously in these times, but I do want to honor what you've come to know through the time that you've spent there, and what you've seen with your own eyes, felt with your own heart, and what, in light of your experience there, mandates your conscience to speak now.
Do you want to begin?
Sure. Thanks, everybody who's here and is online or wherever you are in the ether. I'm honored to be here, and I'm extremely pleased that it was possible to put this together. This is the second Palestine Festival of Literature event that has been canceled and canceled again, and the heroic organizers managed to pull it together. They did the same thing in London, where I was supposed to speak last Friday, and it was canceled and canceled again. In London, they sent the anti-terrorism police to the Royal Geographic Society and told them they could not hold the event, but they held it anyway. My connection to Palestine is obviously a personal one. My family is from there. I have family there now. My niece's family is actually in Gaza. They live in Riman, which is a neighborhood of Gaza right near the sea, or not far from the sea. They fled from their home under bombardment to the southern part of Gaza. They were being bombarded there, and so they went back to the shelter of their home. And then just yesterday, because they were warned that the neighborhood would be bombed, they moved to the Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza, which is, like all hospitals in Gaza, threatened by the Israeli military with being bombed. So that's part of my connection, and I have family in other places there. I was there last in March, and it was obvious that the situation was on the point of exploding. One has to be there to see exactly how awful occupation and dispossession and decades of living as people have had to live, whether in refugee camps or in other parts of occupied Palestine, whether they're Palestinian citizens living as fifth-class citizens in Israel, whether they're in the Gaza Strip, whether they're in the West Bank, whether they're in Jerusalem. I should say that my wish is that every single one of you has a chance to go there. People who have been there have found it a transformative experience. You actually cannot believe what settler colonialism is like. You cannot believe that in the 21st century, this is being done to an entire people unless you see it. You can read about it. You can understand it theoretically, but you have to see it. And I urge those of you who have the opportunity to please try and go there.
Yeah, I want to pick up on where Rashid left off. I went with PALFest. Yasmin, and Omar, and all the organizers of PALFest hosted me. And I was there for 5 days. I'm in occupied territories in Jerusalem, and then I stayed another 5 days after that. And I had this degree of anxiety about going because I knew I was going to see something, something I couldn't quite name. And I knew because of my upbringing, because of my mother, because of my father, because of my wife, because of my son, because of my community, that after I saw the thing, I would have to come back and talk about it. That there was no option in which I did not talk about it. And I thought I was going to another country. But in fact, what amazed me was I actually felt that I was in the same country. But I was in a different time. I was in the time of my parents and my grandparents. I can think back to all of the articles I've read, all the things I've seen said about how complicated and how complex the situation is and the occupation is. I say it's complex, it's complicated. And it's made to sound as though you need a degree in Middle Eastern studies or some such. A PhD to really understand what's happening. But I understood the first day. We went to East Jerusalem to try to visit in the way that Muslims visit to Al-Aqsa Mosque. And I can remember being there, and there were four IDF guards, biggest guns I'd ever seen in my life. And they checked IDs, and they gave us our IDs back. And then they did nothing. They just made us wait. And we waited, and we waited, and we waited. There was no list. There was no protocol. There was no anything. They were just making us wait because they could. And somewhere in the back of my mind, I was like, I know what this is. I know exactly what this is. The second day we went to Hebron, and I can remember walking down streets with a Palestinian guide, and we would get to certain streets and he would say, I can't walk down this street with you. You can walk, I cannot, because I'm Palestinian. And I thought, I know what that is. As we drove through the occupied territories and I would look out and I would see roads that Palestinians could use, and roads that only Israeli Jews could use. I said, I know what this is. As I saw different colored license plates for different classes of people, I said, I know what this is. As I saw communities that I can only describe as segregated, I said, this is Chicago. It's Baltimore. It's Philadelphia. And I don't mean to center the whole world on America. We have a tendency to do that. But my lens is my lens. This is all I have. And what I felt was a tremendous weight. I felt the obvious thing that I think all of us feel, that our tax dollars are effectively subsidizing apartheid, subsidizing a segregationist order, a Jim Crow regime. But I also felt that as an African American who was reared on the fight against Jim Crow, against white supremacy, against apartheid, I felt tremendous shame. How could I not know? How could I not know that the only democracy in the Middle East as it builds itself is segregated? How did I not know that? And what I came to, Michelle, was that Israel is a democracy, the only democracy in the Middle East, in the exact same way that America is the oldest democracy in the world. So the relationship was quite clear. It was quite clear, it was palpable, it was felt, and the responsibility was clear after that.
So let's take a step back and talk a little bit about the history. Both of you have written a lot about the importance of understanding history in order to engage meaningfully with our present. Both of you have talked about history as ongoing processes rather than as complete, finished, and in the past. And you've written that there was no isolated event, the Nakba, that began and ended in 1948, but rather a 100 years war on Palestine. And so I'm wondering if you could share with us what you think people need to know, need to understand about the history of Palestine in order to act in meaningful and courageous ways now, and also what do they need to know about the history of Palestinian resistance, since it is so often portrayed in the media in such an ahistorical fashion, as though Palestinian resistance is driven by hate rather than by a natural, unquenchable yearning to be free. And so share with us what we need to know in your view.
Thanks, Michelle. What we need to know, all of us, is more about the history. What we need to know is, I think, summed up in the title of the book that you just mentioned. This is part of a 100 years war on Palestine. It's not a war in Palestine. It's a war to implant a settler colonial presence at the expense of an indigenous people, which is being pushed out slowly but surely. And when we say the Nakba, the disaster, we start by talking about what happened in 1948. But that's part of a much longer process.
Can you explain what happened in 1948?
I will. In 1948, 750,000 Palestinians were driven from their homes, starting months before the State of Israel was created, including 70,000 people in Jaffa, 70,000 people in Haifa, the two of the largest Arab cities in Palestine, 30,000 people in Jerusalem, all of this before Israel was even created. And then, once Israel was created, once the war between Israel and the Arab states started, hundreds of thousands of more were driven out. That was not a result of war. That was part of a settler colonial process which dictates that you must eliminate, reduce, push out the indigenous population in order to replace it with settlers. That is what Israel is. Israel is a national fact, but it is also a settler colonial fact. It is a fact very similar to the facts that were created in Ireland by settlers sent over by England to push the indigenous population to the west of Ireland. Settlers brought to this country to push the indigenous population west and out of the land that white colonists wanted to settle. It's different, but it's different in its specifics, but it's exactly the same process. And the war is not one between equals. It is a war between a indigenous population and a externally supported, powerful movement rooted always in Western Europe and the United States. This is the metropole for that project. This is where that project gets its money, its guns, its vetoes in the Security Council. Without that, we wouldn't be where we are. Without the Balfour Declaration, without the British and the French, without the United States. And I think it's really, really important to understand all of these facts, that this has been a process which is driven by a demographic imperative to create a Jewish majority in a country which until 1948 had an overwhelming Arab majority, to create a Jewish state, which was the objective of Zionism. In an overwhelmingly Arab land, you had to reduce the Arab population. And in order to do that, you had ultimately to use force. That's what the Nakba starts with, force. Hundreds of thousands more are pushed out after the 1967 war. And in the interim, there's constant pressure on Palestinians to leave. Permits are revoked. Residencies are revoked. You're not allowed to enter. You're not allowed to retain this citizenship or to live here. All of it designed to squeeze the population either out of the country or into smaller and smaller spaces. You can call them Area A, Area B, Area C. You can call them Bantustans. You can call them Native American reservations. It's the same thing. It's the same process. It's the same logic. It's the same racism. And I guess the last thing I'd say about the history is that in this unequal struggle, which involves unremitting violence, one of the first leaders of the Zionist movement, a man named Zev Jabotinsky, the spiritual father of every government since Yitzhak Shamir's government, he said it, we need an iron wall, we need force, or we cannot do this. Every native population resists its dispossession. That's not me, that's Jabotinsky. And he said it again and again and again. And that is what has produced Palestinian resistance, unremitting violence. You cannot have dispossession. You cannot have people's homes and property taken away without the use of violence. You cannot force 750,000 people from their homes without violence. And that is what the Palestinians have suffered in this war. And they have resisted. Sometimes they've been successful. Sometimes they've been unsuccessful. Sometimes that resistance was political or nonviolent. And quite frequently, it was violent. Violence inevitably breeds violence. And every time the Palestinians have tried to resist nonviolently, the response was almost more ferocious than violent resistance. Why? Because if boycott, divestment, and sanctions, or action before the International Criminal Court, or the Great March of Return in Gaza a couple of years ago, when Israeli snipers shot down hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of unarmed demonstrators, if those things can succeed, then Israel is naked in a way that it's not. When the resistance is violent. So when you ask, why do you have violent resistance? You have violent resistance both because in order to impose this separate colonial reality on this people, unremitting, unceasing violence has been applied to them. And because, finally, people can only take so much. People can only take so much. And so I think that in order to understand this, and in order to advocate effectively for this cause, it's really necessary for us to understand all of these things, to understand the legal aspects, the kind of things that Noura Erekat has written about, to understand details about the politics, the kinds of things that many other people have written about, and to understand the history. This has been portrayed by a movement that is political, that is national. I'm talking about Zionism. That is economic, that is military, but is also a public relations project. It has sold a picture, what you were talking about, Ta-Nehisi, which people have swallowed with their mother's milk. And it is necessary to deconstruct that, and the only way to do that is to know better than they do the reality of what has been happening in Palestine for more than 100 years.
Ta-Nehisi, you can respond to that, but also I'm especially interested in your thoughts about the history of Black solidarity with the Palestinian struggle and kind of the extent to which you think it's vital for Black people to be in solidarity with Palestine and the struggle to free Palestine today.
Yeah, well, I'll say a couple of things. I think it's really important to acknowledge something. And that is that, I'm a relative latecomer to this. It's not something that I had a real knowledge of. I had an intuition for it. I had an awareness of the tradition. But it really was not until I went there that I had a tactile feeling for it. One of the things that I will probably be making amends for until the day they put me in the ground, if I'm honest, is in one of my most celebrated works of journalism, when I had to demonstrate tangibly how a reparations program could be done, I looked to Israel. And I think about that. And one of my golden rules about writing is that, you only write after you've reported, you only write after. And I wrote without going. And so while there is this long tradition of solidarity, for me personally, there's a thing of making amends. And it is terribly, ferociously important to me. I think about that, and I think about how gracious people were when I was over there. I think about how they took me into their homes. I think about how they fed me. And I think about how their only request was, when you go back, don't lose your voice. That was all they asked. And so for me, I am obviously aware of the tradition. But this is like personal. You know what I mean? Like I have some debts to pay. And I think it's really, really important that I be clear about that.
Yes, well.
I feel like I came late to my awareness as well. I had heard things. Including one time from a friend, a good friend who is not prone to hyperbole, who went to Palestine, returned, and said, I was active in the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa and had been to South Africa many times. He says, but what I saw in Israel and Palestine was worse than what I had seen there. And I remember filing that fact away somewhere, what he said, but imagine that the work that I was doing at home was what was most deserving of my attention. And it wasn't until the Ferguson uprisings when I began to hear that activists on the street who were facing tear gas and tanks, they were getting advice from Palestinians halfway across the globe, tweeting to them about how to deal with militaristic occupation and attacks, and following the experience that those activists had in Ferguson, many of them went to Palestine and came back with stories and deep knowledge of the history. And as I began to learn more, I also came to learn that the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was staunchly in support of the Palestinian cause, that Muhammad Ali had identified himself as strongly in support of the Palestinian cause, that there was a long tradition of, black activists standing in solidarity with Palestinians. And I have to give a shout out to my sister's new book. She's a historian. She just published a book called Fear of a Black Republic. It's about Haiti and the rise and the birth of black internationalism in the United States. But it is that long history of black people understanding that their struggle for liberation crosses boundaries and that solidarity is necessary across those boundaries, I think, is calling to us now. And the fact that
Palestinians were supporting folks in the street of Ferguson, and who also, I've heard, were showing their support for people in Flint, Michigan, giving advice about how to survive when your water's shut off. And so it's encouraging to me to hear about that kind of international solidarity in this time. But let's turn to some political realities in the United States right now. The United States' support, as we all know, for Israel has been absolutely unwavering for decades, even among supposedly progressive politicians and elected officials. Mark Lamont Hill and Mitchell Plichnik have written an excellent book called Except for Palestine, The Limits of Progressive Politics. And I'd love to hear from both of you a little bit about these political realities in the United States right now. We are witnessing in real time exactly how unshakable the support is for Israel as the Biden administration refuses to draw any lines in the sand or place any limitations at all on the billions of dollars of aid that we send to Israel every year, even as it commits horrific war times broadcast around the globe. Why is our government not only tolerating this, but sending billions more dollars to Israel? And before you answer, I want to note that I think a clue can be found in a speech that a young U.S. senator named Joe Biden delivered on the Senate floor in June 1986. It's available on YouTube. He said defiantly, quote, "If we look at the Middle East, I think it's about time we stop apologizing for our support for Israel. There is no apology to be made, none. It is the best $3 billion investment we make. Were there not an Israel, the United States of America would have to invent in Israel to protect our interests in the region. The United States would have to go out and invent in Israel," end quote. So what was Biden saying exactly? What do we need to understand about U.S. support for Israel?
Hot potato, eh? I think we need to understand a bunch of things. We need to understand that there's a strategic thing there. Serves American imperial interests. Has always done. That's why the British started this project. They did not do it for the brown eyes of the Jewish people. They did it because it was in the strategic interests of the British Empire. And that's one reason the United States does it. We do not give $3.8 billion a year plus the $10 billion that Biden's asked for additionally this year for anything to do with sentiment. It has to do with strategy, it has to do with oil, it has to do with interests, imperial interests. It has to do with a couple other things. It does have to do with the evangelical right. That's one of the things that moved Britain to support the Balfour Declaration, to support a Jewish national home in an almost entirely Arab country. And it's one of the things that moves American politicians, the votes, the money, the concentrated political power of the evangelical right. It has to do with money. Our politicians are whores. They're bought and sold. That needs to be said. And the bigger the donor, the more services they get. And that's part of it. And if we ask, why is it that our media is so complicit? Well, it's partly because our media is a echo chamber for the people in power in Washington. I read the New York Times some mornings, and I say the New York Pravda Times. And I read the Washington Post. I read the Washington Izvestia Post. They are like the Soviet press during the Cold War. They are, whether it's the Ukraine war or whether it's this war, they echo power. But they also echo money. Who owns the Washington Post? Jeff Bezos. Who owns MSNBC NBC, who are, MSNBC, NBC Universal, who owns those institutions of the press? The same people who own the politicians. The same people who own our universities. Who runs our universities? Who runs our universities? Not the presidents and the deans and the department chairmen and women. It's the Board of Trustees. What is the Board of Trustees? It's the same people who finance the politicians, same people who own the media. So if we see a compliant media with a government that is supportive of Israel because of votes, because of the evangelical right, because of imperial strategic objectives, it's very simple. When we see university administrations kowtowing to one narrative on Palestine, as they have done right across the country, it's for the same reason that our media does it and the same reason that our government does it. It's money, it's power. It's very, very, very simple. I can give you a more sophisticated explanation, but I think that that really sums it up, frankly.
I don't have a better answer to that.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I reflect on the fact that...
Can I say something? I hope I did not insult sex workers. I did not mean to do that. I did not mean to do that. I'm very sorry.
Appreciate.
They're far above politicians. Sorry.
Well, I think we should probably spend a minute talking about censorship. Fear and censorship. I know that both of you have significant experience with censorship, having your work censored. I do too. And we have seen in recent years the censorship of books labeled critical race theory, which turned out to be a very broad category. Books about LGBTQ people and issues. Kind of the scope of censorship keeps broadening. But we are seeing now kind of new forms, or very old forms, of being born again of censorship in this kind of war context. And I do worry about the possibility of us entering into another McCarthyite era, the challenges of finding a site just for this conversation. I think speak the real risk of that. And I wonder if both of you, and I'll start with you, say a little bit about where you think we are right now in terms of censorship. And as was mentioned earlier, people have real fears that are grounded, in reality. The possibility of losing jobs, of retaliation, and even being attacked violently or killed as a result of expressing their views. Where are we now in terms of censorship? What do you fear? And how do you think people ought to respond in this moment in time?
You know, oddly enough, I think we're in a great place. and I don't say that blithely. I say that... as you mentioned, having some very, very direct experience with my own work being banned in schools and libraries, and then this week helping where I could, and ultimately, you know, it was you, Michelle, but trying to, you know, figure out where we could hold this event, seeing, you know, Yasmin go through all of the, you know, hoops. So what I've gleaned from that is when people start resorting to instruments as blunt and direct as book bans or not allowing discussions, they're threatened. It's the weapon of a weak and a decaying order. Yeah, I'll just tell you a little story. I never forget. I came back, right? I come back from Palestine. It's like, late May, and I'm going crazy. Like, I'm going to sleep, and I'm, dreaming about Palestine, and I'm, waking up, and I got that glassy-eyed look in my face, and my wife is worried about me, and everybody's worried about me. And I emailed a friend, and I said, do you have a contact with Rashid Khalidi at all? And he said, yeah, I do. And he connected us, and I wrote him. I said, listen, man, you don't know me from Adam, but I got to talk to somebody about what I saw. And he said, it's okay. He said, look, I'm having a dinner this weekend. Why don't you and your wife come? And I came, and we sat in community, and it was the thing that I needed. And among the many things that she said that night, he said, I have been fighting this fight for a long time, and I've never seen our side this strong. I've never seen the students of the university so galvanized. I've never... And, you can confuse the ferociousness of the pushback with strength. You know what I mean? But the fact of the matter is, in African-American history, for instance, here in our struggle, the struggle is the most violent when people are the most threatened. The original and the oldest and the most lethal form of domestic terrorism was pioneered after the Civil War. And what it was in response to the fact that suddenly you had multiple states throughout this country with black majorities. You had a majority black legislature in South Carolina. The pushback had to be ferocious. It had to be violent. It needed to be because of the sheer strength of the threat. That's generally been our history. And so now in this moment, when I look out and I see, not just my work band, but I see the work of my colleagues' band. I see, as you mentioned, LGBTQ authors' band. When I situate myself within the history of black writing, and I understand the fact that there was never any safe moment for black writing in this country's history. When I understand that when Frederick Douglass publishes his narrative and he goes and he talks about it, he has a price on it. He can be dragged back into slavery at any moment. When I understand that Ida B. Wells was driven out of Memphis, Tennessee for reporting on the lynching and the murder of her friends, and she continued to report on it nonetheless. When I understand that Elijah Lovejoy was shot to death and his press was shoved into the river, you have to be realistic about this moment. What happened to you, man? You had to find another location for your talk tonight. That was it. Actually quite simple compared to the long history of things. My wife was kind enough to send me an article about this district where they had banned Between the World and Me, right? And it'd been, and this is a deep red district, and there'd been this whole fight about it. And they went and they interviewed the library. And the librarian said, this is the most checked out book we've ever had. It's not because of me, that's because of the ban. You understand what I'm saying? And so, like, the very fact that you guys are here, the very unfortunate fact that some of you who are watching this couldn't get in, you know what I mean? The fact that we had to struggle to find a venue for this event doesn't say anything about the strength of this movement here. It doesn't say anything about our strength. It says a lot about the threat and what people feel and the weakness. So, I don't know. Anybody that knows me knows that I am not one known for my optimism. But I feel it in this moment. I really do.
I mean, I don't have much to say after that. But I'm completely convinced that Ta-Nehisi's right. The first thing is this idea that the international community supports what Israel is doing acts as if the United States, Western Europe, and a few white settler colonies in Japan are the international community. They aren't. They're a pimple on the backside of humanity. The international community is India and China, Bangladesh, Indonesia, Pakistan, Congo, Nigeria, Brazil. I could go on. Those are the people who voted in the United Nations for a ceasefire. 120 countries. There were 14. There were 14 that voted against. Six island nations, the United States, Israel, and a bunch of hangers-on. That's not the world. The world is actually with us. Indeed, in this country, the press, no. The politicians, no. The universities, certainly no. And by that, I mean the administrations. But look at the campus that I teach on. 5 years ago, Columbia students voted overwhelmingly in support of boycott, divestment, and sanctions of companies that support the occupation. Overwhelmingly. Same thing happened at Brown. Same thing happened at Barnard. Same thing happened at Michigan. Same thing happened at almost every university where the thing was put to a vote. The students are with us. By a vote, we know that. I was on the television the other day for my sins. It's a terrible thing to go on television. I promise you, don't do it if you don't have to. And I mentioned that young people are with us. And the God bless her, the interviewer said to me, yeah, there's a poll here that says on Biden's handling of the Gaza situation, in the age group from 18 to 35, he has 10% support. 10%! I could give you more polls. They are terrified of us. That's why we're getting censorship.
All right. Well, we are running out of time. But I couldn't end this conversation with bringing it back to kind of the question of conscience and what's required of us in these times. We're sitting here in James Chapel, and I began earlier talking about Dr. King's speech against the Vietnam War. Dr. King called the United States the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. And he was condemned for it. You know, Time magazine called the speech demagogic slander that sounded like a script from Radio Hanoi. And the Washington Post declared that King had, quote, diminished his usefulness to his cause, his country, his people. So, Ta-Nehisi, I would love for you to share your thoughts both about that speech, media's reaction at the time, and also kind of what it might teach us about what's required of us now.
That speech is incredible. I literally listened to it last night, but it is, it's incredible. I was going to say it's ridiculous, but that's probably, it's ridiculously good. You know, I just want to take that in a different direction. I think, you know, as largely because of my upbringing, I think largely because of where I was in the world, I probably did not comprehend the ethic of nonviolence. Like, I just didn't get it, you know. But I always knew, like, when I read that speech, I still didn't get it. But the fact that he would hold the United States government to the same standard, as he said in the speech, that he would hold, you know, young folks in the ghetto on the west side of Chicago, I thought, wow, okay, well, he really believes it. So there was this sincerity. It has taken years, and I've tried to work this out in my work, to understand nonviolence as an ethic. And I understood it in Israel. King would talk about, like, the corrupting influence of violence, like what it did to the soul. And I have to say, and this is really, really important, as much as I saw my world through the eyes of the Palestinians, I saw what I can only describe as an alternative history through the eyes of Israeli Jews. I understood how pain, oppression, genocide, how you can take the wrong lesson from it. and how you can take the lesson that the real problem is that I did not have power, that I did not have the guns. And, like, it was sad. I went to Yad Vashem, and it was a deeply, deeply moving experience. Like, just incredibly. I can remember coming in, and the first thing I saw was, like, this collection of home movies that had been taken before the Holocaust. And it just, I mean, it broke me. And I walked through, and anybody tells you it wasn't as bad as they say it was bad. It was worse. And I was so clear on that. And I got to the end. And I walked outside, and there was a line of young soldiers out there with guns. And I just thought, what would it mean for all of the suffering that I've endured as a black person individually? What would it mean for all of the violence that we've endured ourselves, for all the babies that were bombed in churches, for the fact that we as a people are the products of rape and sexual assault, that it marks every one of us down to our genes? What would it mean to have suffered some 250 years of enslavement, a period longer than our time of freedom? And to derive from that, that what we really need is power. And what we do with that power really doesn't matter as long as we safeguard ourselves. I was watching the news yesterday, and I saw, in fact, my congressman, actually. And journalists asked him, he said, how do you measure the amount of death, the body count? At what point is it enough? At what point do you say, you know what, this is actually too much, this is actually tipping into something? And my man couldn't give a number. He couldn't say when it was too much. Mm-hmm. And some people will watch that and get angry, and I understand that. And I watched it and got really sad, because I understood it. And I understood in me how the rage, the anger, the deep felt pain of your own oppression, how you can take the wrong lesson from it. Mm-hmm. And that's really what King was trying to ward. Then I got him. You understand what I'm saying? Then I got, like, he would always talk about nonviolence for your soul. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And then I got it. Like, I really, really understood. So, you know, as much as the lessons were really, really clear that I got, and as much as I, you know, thank, you know, my Palestinian host, I have to tell you, I mean, the opportunity to observe Israeli society was like it was a peek into a way not taken. Maybe because that wasn't an option. Thank God it wasn't an option. But there was a deep, deep sense of sadness. It was the most unsafe place I've ever felt in my life. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean in the occupied territories. Mm-hmm. I mean in Jerusalem, mm-hmm. Tel Aviv. Mm-hmm. I felt power. I felt people with power. But I didn't feel a safety.
So, would you like to share any final words? We've got to close now, and you know, I think as we sit here, as in the center of the most powerful empire in the world, we need to think about what our responsibility is. As King said in speech, to those who have been defined as our enemy, and consider not just like what we must say, but what we must do. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you have thoughts that you want to share.
I do. Thank you. One of the things that I argue in this book that you mentioned is this is not a war on the Palestinians waged by the Zionist movement or Israel alone. It's a war waged on the Palestinian people by Israel and the United States. Those are our weapons. Those are American F-35s, American F-15s, American F-16s, American 175-millimeter guns, American 155-millimeter guns. They fire shells of 100 pounds each. I could tell you their kill radius. I could tell you how large the diameter of a 2,000-pound bomb dropped from an American plane is. That's us, our tax dollars, our votes. We have to do something about our complicity in the killing so far of 9,000 people, almost 4,000 of them children, our complicity in the wounding of 21,000 people, and our complicity in 2,000 people being missing. And worse than that, if it, heaven forbid, should happen, would be our complicity in further ethnic cleansing of Palestine. The White House sent Congress a bill for aid to the Ukraine and Israel. It includes provisions for moving Palestinians out of Gaza. You can read it. It was sent by the Office of Management and Budget on the 20th of October. Now, the president hastened to speak to the Egyptian president and to the Jordanian king, both of whom had been told by Blinken that the United States wanted them to accept Palestinian refugees to be driven out of Gaza by Israel in completion of an ethnic cleansing process of a Nakba that's been going on since 1948. We must oppose with action, with words, not just weapons that we send to Israel to kill people with, being used in that way. Incidentally, in violation of U.S. law. U.S. law mandates that weapons can only be used for defensive purposes. Why do you think they keep saying in every one of their statements that Israel has a right to defend itself? Because otherwise, they would be in violation of U.S. law in sending those weapons to Israel. If killing children in Jabalia camp is a defensive purpose, then it's legal. And if it's not, they're in violation of the law. We must oppose that, and we must oppose the possibility of the United States being complicit in ethnic cleansing. We must oppose it as strongly as we can. Otherwise, we are the ethnic cleansers, and we are the killers. We may not be the ones pulling the trigger. We may not be the people forcing people out into Egypt or into Jordan, but we are responsible. Our government has just said that it's willing to fund that. Now, maybe they'll pull back on it, but they'll only pull back on it if we make them stop. Thank you.
I'll let you have the final word.
You know, I just want to say thank you once again. I saw more of Israel and Palestine occupied territories than I have seen of any country ever. I saw Tel Aviv, I saw Haifa, I saw Jaffa, I saw Bezet, I saw Ramallah, I saw Susia. I saw so much, and I had tutors all the way through. When I'm sitting right here, I went to Sheikh Jarrah and Muhammad tutored me. I am back here. I got to spend some time with Nora, and Nora is tutoring me. I started your book. It's incredible. And so I just I feel privileged to have the opportunity to see in somebody else's struggle, not just my own, but like, as you were saying, to have my consciousness heightened, to understand more about myself through other people. And you know, my only way to say thank you, my only way to pay that back is, as I said, you know, to keep the promise that, you know, I made when I was over there, and that is to use my voice. I'm much more comfortable using my pen, but in the midst of bombs being dropped on children, we have to speak.
You have been listening to Ta-Nehisi Coates, Rashid Khalidi, and Michelle Alexander speaking out about the genocide Israel and the United States are carrying out in Gaza. And that is it for this week. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine. Please join us again next week and every week as we give voice to Palestinians' resistance to Israel's occupation and colonization of their homeland. This is John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.